Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending the next few minutes speaking with Mark Singer, who has been a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine for a number of decades and is well known for quite a number of things he has written, including the books Funny Money and Somewhere in America. And maybe right now people are remembering especially, well, a quite extraordinary portrait which he wrote back in 1996 for The New Yorker about Donald Trump. And as a matter of fact, Mark Singer has revisited that portrait from about 20 years ago in a new book called Trump and Me. It is published by Tim Duggan Books and with a very interesting and entertaining foreword by David Remnick. And I'm really excited to have the next few minutes to speak with Mark Singer about Trump and Me. Mark Singer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Happy to be here.
Can I just ask you really quickly, because The New Yorker is such an interesting publication that so many people enjoy and admire, what has it been like for you to be a part of The New Yorker for all of these years? And just what sort of a feast of opportunity has it represented for you?
Well, it's been extremely fortunate break that I got early in my life. I went to The New Yorker as a writer in 1974 when I was only a couple of years out of college. And I've spent my career there. What the best part of it, there's certainly been a great deal of freedom, but above all, the colleagues that I have there, people who are so extraordinarily dedicated and engaged with the world. They're just the fact-checking department, for example, at The New Yorker, the people there, their intellectual range and efficiency, but just the amount of stuff they know. And I'm not one of these writers who complains about editing ever, because I've been blessed with the really rigorous and valuable editing I've gotten there.
Very good. Let's talk about this moment in the fall of 1996 when you, in a sense, receive marching orders from the woman who was editor of The New Yorker at the time, Tina Brown. Describe to our listeners what happened and the assignment that was given to you.
Well, I just finished writing a book and had been away from the magazine for a good part of 4 years. I've been writing pieces during that time, but not as many as they would have liked. So for the magazine, I mean, I've been writing pieces. And so I my phone rings one day, and it's Tina telling me, Trump, Donald Trump, you know, you're going to write a profile of him. And he's absolutely full of it, and you're going to love it, and him, and he's going to love you, which meant I was doing it. I didn't really have an option there. I didn't want to do it because I write about people whenever I can who are not celebrated, who are not well-known, people who are very good at what they do, but do it with a relative anonymity. And that was certainly not the case here. But I approached this with a blank slate as much as possible. It's kind of impossible to have a complete blank slate when it came to Trump. But I knew I had to do something that that hadn't already been done. And so I tried to just find out exactly what is this guy's business. You know, you knew that he had real estate, but it was very difficult, and that there were these casinos, but it was very difficult to tell what he owned, how he ended up with his names on things, what that name meant, that entire process. And there was a lot to read about him and a lot of books that had been published with his byline. But obviously, one needs to go beneath the surface of that stuff. So I just got busy, and I talked to many people in New York City who had watched him over the years doing sort of maneuvering in socially, but also in order to get things built politically, and who had watched his ego inflate over time, and they had a lot to say. So I was helped a great deal during that reporting.
So I'm curious, was this, or maybe you don't even know the answer to this, but was this more Donald Trump's idea? Was he looking to generate still more publicity, or was this Tina Brown's idea, or did they just sort of hatch this mutually?
I think it was a marriage of convenience. I think she, Tina was had a certain vision of what the New Yorker should be that has changed greatly since her departure in 1998, and she was interested in celebrity, frankly, and in a way that I wasn't crazy about, but I enjoyed being at the New Yorker, so it was kind of a tricky tight wire walk that I had to do at times. And so she wanted a piece about Trump just because Trump sells, probably in some sense, which seems cynical perhaps, but and he always wanted attention, so and his ego is his narcissism and his lack of self-awareness would you know, sort of prohibited him thinking maybe there might be some downside to this.
Right. So what exactly was, in a sense, the agreement brokered in terms of how you were going to go about creating this portrait, and specifically, what kind of access were you granted to Mr. Trump? It sounds like quite a lot of it.
Well, there wasn't any agreement brokered. It was I go see Trump in his office at the outset, and we talk, and I did explain to him that I would like access as much as he could allow, but that when he didn't want me around, to tell me to leave. I don't want to be where I'm not welcome, that whenever possible, and he had some place that he was going or that he wanted to have me along, I was most happy if I could just be a fly on the wall. I didn't really ask a lot of questions along the way because it wasn't necessary. I was observing. I always have written this sort of these profiles with a certain cinematic quality to them, so that there's a lot of scenery in there where I'm just narrating dialogue and, you know, describing maybe what the room looks like. And so that reporting process went on over several months, and then probably 4 or 5 months. And Tina is getting, you know, impatient for the piece, more like 4 months. So I have to write, and it was a long piece. I knew I had a great deal of room to write. This turned out to be 10,000 words. And so I wrote it, but I had not figured out how to end it. Literally, I did not know how to end this thing. And so I sent in a version of the piece to my editor by fax. Remember those machines? And I sent this in on a Thursday night. I said, look, I don't have an ending, but here's what I got. Got in to bed. I had a clock radio by my bed tuned to an all-new station, and I tapped it, and top of the hour, Donald Trump and Marla Maples are getting divorced. So that gave me a timely hook. I needed to get in to see him. I did the following Monday. And we closed the piece that week, went to press, and I had a lot of rewriting, but I got what I needed to both really open and close the book.
Mm. Before we talk about how it was received and then digging into some specifics, I want to talk a little more about the matter of spending the time that you did with Mr. Trump. Remind us of what sort of span of time we are talking about, and within that span of time, how often would you be with him? And would you show up unannounced, or would these be arranged with his staff? And I'm also very curious about this matter of being the fly on the wall, which you describe as far as you're concerned, optimal working conditions. I mean, that was just sort of a perfect scenario for someone doing what you wanted to do. In fact, how much of the time do you think you were a fly on the wall that was all but ignored by Mr. Trump? In other words, how aware was he most of the time of your presence in the room, observing him and listening to all of the things he was saying and seeing all the things he was doing?
The total amount of time spent, I would say, this is over a period of, you know, 4 or 5 months of reporting, would maybe add up to, 2 weeks or less. That said, and I never would show up unannounced. Only when I was, told that there was something happening and I might want to do. If I was getting just frozen out, I would have been, petitioning for more time. But it wasn't necessary. He was generous with his accessibility. After the piece was published, and it turned out that he didn't like it, he attacked me in a book a few months after the New Yorker piece came out. And in it he said when Mark Singer came into my office, I could immediately tell that he was not much of anything, nondescript, with a faint wise guy sneer and some kind of chip on his shoulder. And he went on to attack my physical appearance and whatnot. Now, when I read this later, I loved it, of course, having him say that. But that notion that I was not much of anything, I think, took root immediately, because people are just tools to him. So it was very easy to be invisible. And, when I would engage with him, there were times when I was one-on-one with him, so I obviously wasn't invisible. He had to, engage with me. It's always about Trump. He had not one iota of curiosity about who I am as a person, which is fine. My experience as a reporter is always the thing you most want in any relationship with a subject is to be underestimated. And so I had that going for me in spades, because he underestimates everyone around him, or at least he regards himself as superior to everyone around him.
Right.
And so it was just then, I'm a polite person, and I certainly wasn't going to alienate this person. I wasn't going to engage him in any hostile way, and I didn't.
You say at one point, unaccustomed though I am, you're now at this point in the book speaking in the present tense, but I think you're taking us back to 1996. Unaccustomed though I am, I have to take Donald Trump seriously. So in other words, you were in this moment sort of shifting gears to observe him in a way that you had not observed him before. Beyond just the actually being present in his sphere, what are the other ways in which you were trying to take Mr. Trump seriously?
Well, that was a figure of speech, and I wrote that in the voice of the historical present.
So sure.
Describing now what that was like. But Donald Trump was a buffoon back then. There wasn't yet the Celebrity Apprentice, but I had a description of his public image during the 1980s, and which I described as a sort of Oprah Buffa parody of wealth. It was hard to believe that anyone wanted to project the image that he was perfectly happy to, of utter excess, what we would think of as decadence, but which he thought was really good for business, the branding. And I think there was a truth to that. He was an aspirational figure for certain people, and not obviously all over the world after a certain point, all over America once The Apprentice came around. But I just think that he connected, and he had a populist, tendency then. I described in that original piece when we were at an opening of a building with his name on it, the building in New York City at Columbus Circle, the Trump International Hotel, and he was there for the grand opening and worked the room, and then he was leaving, and we're getting into his car to go back to the Trump Tower, just not that far away, but it's a drive in a limo for him. And before we drove off, he jumps out of the car and he goes over to these parking lot attendants who were working at this particular building, that this new building. And he just goes and tells them, you know, it's great to have you guys aboard, fellas, and you're going to have jobs for a long time. Now, that is, there's a kind of genius to that. It seems simple to do, but how many people do that, especially very wealthy people who even acknowledge the existence of, you know, regular folk. So Trump connected that way. And he was a Queens guy. I mean, he was from a very wealthy family, but he had a familiarity with the outer boroughs of New York, and that's never changed. And that's part of the reason why people find him charismatic, because he does entertain also. He's very entertaining. Whether you're watching him now on Fox News and enjoying him, or watching him on MSNBC and are somehow horrified, you're still entertained. he had that going for him all along. Much more charisma than anybody else who was running for president this time around.
We're speaking with Mark Singer and talking about his book, Trump and Me. In this book, he, in part, recounts the experience of drawing a detailed portrait of Donald Trump for the New Yorker magazine back in 1996. He revisits that experience and adds some latter-day perspective to his understanding of who Donald Trump was and remains. One thing that you call him more than once in your book is a performance artist. And I find this really an intriguing moment in the book, that you're sort of getting at the heart of part of what made this a challenging assignment for you. You write, during our first encounter in his office in Trump Tower, I grasped that whoever or whatever I had previously imagined Trump to be, he is foremost a performance artist. Appearance is never not, at some level, artifice. My objective is to apprehend the person within the persona. Just how hard was it to do that?
I think it became an education process. I remember returning from my first conversation with him. It was probably an hour in his office, during which he, you know, regaled me with his wonderfulness and how successful he was. And this is the same conversation in which we discussed, you know, the terms and when I would, you know, whether when I could stick around and when I had to leave and all the fly on the wall terms. But I just realized this person is an actor. He is and performance artist, you know, is a term that attaches to art itself. And I thought that the odd part of this guy is that he's a businessman, but this is in some sort of Warholian sense, art. And once I understood that, it was very easy to adjust. And I spent the whole time waiting to see if there was a real person beneath that carapace of quote Donald Trump unquote, and that person never really shows up in that piece. And I don't think that he has any desire to expose his naked self, as you know, to people, and he doesn't even want to expose his naked self to himself. He really is comfortable to live a sort of I'm missing an adjective here, but a life that is lived on the surface.
At one point in trying to describe this, I think you touch on something so intriguing by saying that, especially back in his ascendancy back in the 1980s, you write, the essence of Donald Trump's performance art was an opera bouffe parody of wealth. That you're speaking to something that's a very important part of the story here. Namely, that it's not just that he's wealthy, or wealthy to varying degrees, depending on at what point in time we're looking, but that his wealth is playing out in kind of an extravagant way that goes beyond, in a sense, the dollars and cents, the reality of the bottom line.
Well, it's all about image and how that can pay for itself. So he's living, I would say, more a lifestyle than a life, but he was within that definition. He was basically trying to be as conspicuous as possible, because he figured that was going to be good for business as he knew it. And I don't know what his conversations with his wife and family were like during that time. He has so little interest in other people, and such a short attention span, and such a general incuriosity about things other than himself, that I concluded, as you're aware, I think, that he used to talk about the real estate he sold as belonging to three categories: luxury, super luxury, and super, super luxury. And that's an interesting taxonomy, and he explained to me kind of what he meant by that. And so it led me to the conclusion that he had aspired to and achieved the ultimate luxury, an existence unmolested by the rumbling of a soul. And that's a fairly harsh verdict, but I felt that it was appropriate.
As you dug into the reality of his business dealings, one of the distinctions that you ended up making, that you repeat in your book, is at what in fact Donald Trump has accomplished, and it's important that we are careful about understanding what it means to be a real estate empresario. But he asserts that he is the biggest real estate developer in New York. And you suggest that the facts do not bear out that claim. It's an interesting distinction.
Well, it was pretty easy assertion to make, given that you could just factually demonstrate it by, you know, going to the whatever the New York City Realty Board or whatever, and determining which developers literally controlled how much property in the city. And he would always say he's the biggest, and he was not anywhere close to the biggest. But if you look at numbers of buildings with someone's name on them, that was Trump. But these were buildings that had been built as condominiums and then sold off, so that his equity in the property is you know, greatly diminished. He has a contract as sort of the managing the operator, the managing agent for these buildings, but he didn't own the real estate anymore, because that was owned by individual buyers. So that kind of thing was the smoke and mirrors of Trump that fooled people for a very long time. And then at a certain point, by the time I got there in the 90s, he had no credit worthiness. He had failed in the Atlantic City, and he was over-leveraged in New York. So nobody was going to lend him money anymore. He'd stiffed all these bankers in the 1990s, you know, walked away from hundreds of millions of dollars, $800 million, which is about the number of obligations. He was too big to fail. That was a classic example of that. He controlled the banks because he owed so much. So it was something that he would never acknowledge. It's likewise, what happened in Atlantic City is finally being, you know, documented. It's been documented a long time ago, but excellent work by one reporter in particular at the Philadelphia Inquirer, then later at the New York Times, David K. Johnston, and also others, Wayne Barrett, a wonderful reporter in New York who really understood Trump brilliantly. And so the goods you know, are demonstrated that this person has a terrible business track record, and he's only his advantage in a lot of senses is just his shamelessness.
At one point, you quote him as saying, "I love leverage."
Right.
What does Mr. Trump mean in this instance when he's talking about leverage? And what are some of the clearest examples of the way in which leverage has played a really important role in his life and in particular his business dealings?
Well, people in business borrow money, and that is what we mean by leverage, that they want to build a project that costs, you know, $10 million, but they've only got, you know, enough money to really to pay for. It's just like a down payment on a house. You need to borrow the rest, but you're building something. If you're in the real estate business, that you're going to sell. So that leverage, that upfront borrowing, is going to deliver a handsome return if the deal works out well, because you've sold it off. And I think that's what he initially meant. But by the time he is saying this to me, first of all, it's ironic because he was no longer credit worthy. And second, he had already been rewarded by I don't even know how the bankers looked at his credit worthiness, but he had personally guaranteed a couple of billion dollars of his debts. He didn't have that money. He never had that money to pay it back, and they had to write it off. And he lost a lot of properties in the process. But I mean, that's what he meant by "I love leverage." I think that it did serve him well, but I also think that it was a function of the carelessness of his lenders.
Right. I think a really telling moment in the book is when you sort of describe this time in the 90s when he is in this kind of trouble. You quote Gail Collins of the New York Times referring to Mr. Trump as a financially embattled thousandaire rather than millionaire or billionaire. But what I find even more interesting is an excerpt that you share from a legal deposition at the time where he was being sued for quite a lot of money. And Mr. Trump himself is quoted as saying in this deposition, "My net worth fluctuates, and it goes up and down with markets and with attitudes and with feelings, even my own feelings. And that can change rapidly from day to day." And that's in some ways kind of a chilling insight into the way he operates in this particular sphere, in which a lot of people believe he's a peerless master.
What it really is insane. But first of all, that was a lawsuit in which he was the plaintiff. He was suing a former New York Times reporter, Timothy O'Brien, who published a book in the called Trump Nation in I think 2006 or 7, and that was the book in which he discovered that Trump, who'd been claiming he was worth many billions of dollars, was probably legitimately worth somewhere between $125 and $250 million. And it was all just BS. Trump sued him for libel for $5 billion. During that proceeding, he gave that deposition in which he acknowledged where he got his figures about his net worth from. And it was just made up. It was just whatever Trump wanted it to be. And also, he ascribed a very high number to his brand, which is at best a provisional number. So I don't think this guy is very complicated, really. He has an unwillingness to lie. Excuse me, he has a willingness to lie that is just boundless.
Hmm.
And, you know, so that leads to these situations.
Right. You just said the word complicated, and this reminds me of another really intriguing moment. I want to read just these couple of lines and then have you elaborate. You write, "One day when I was in Trump's office, he took a phone call from an investment banker. an opaque conversation that after he hung up, I asked him to elucidate. "Whatever complicates the world more, I do," he said. "Come again?" "It's always good to do things nice and complicated so that nobody can figure it out." I wonder how often you saw that principle played out, and to what extent does that seem to be a conscious effort on his part to do things in ways that are intentionally complicated for this reason?
I think when I quoted him saying that, I mean, it's a question I asked and a question he answered, and he answered in that way. And if you're running a private business and it's a diversified business, and there's limited information available to the public, his casinos were public companies, but for the most part, everything else was unknown. That's a good way to make things complicated in and of itself. I think it really wasn't that complicated that he was lying. It was pretty simple about what his net worth was. Was he using that to gain some kind of leverage in another sense? Yes. He was creating an illusion. A lot of the Trump empire is this kind of Potemkin village, that there's something that appears to be one thing on the outside, but it's really just a facade, and there's not much there. And I suppose it's both complicated and simple in that sense. It fools most people. He's still out there. Look, most people, I don't know what the numbers are because the polls are changing. Obviously, we're in a strange time. But I'm amazed that people think that he would be a good steward of the American economy. There's no evidence of that, either in the way that he runs his own business or in the statements that he's made about what he would do to fix things. There's no understanding of any nuance or subtlety that's reflected in it. They're just slogans. It's just big, promises and braggadocio.
We're speaking with Mark Singer about his book Trump and Me. Mr. Singer, do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Sure.
I think when it comes to the way you describe your time spent with Mr. Trump, there are really interesting moments that play out that sometimes you don't even go out of your way to sort of make a grandiose point about. You just sort of let the moment, in a sense, speak for itself. To me, one of those moments comes in an instant when you are riding aboard Trump's own 727. I don't remember where you were going at the time.
We were flying from New York to Palm Beach, where we were on our way to Mar-a-Lago.
Right. Before I ask you about the thing I'm curious about, the movie you watched, maybe you could just sort of describe what this plane was like.
Well, there are several people on the plane. He was giving people a lift down to Palm Beach, friends of his, acquaintances, whatever. One of the people on the plane was Tony Bennett, who was performing at Mar-a-Lago. I think he was a quote-unquote resident artist at Mar-a-Lago. But anyway, Trump's there, and his then, I think, 13-year-old son, Eric, was on the plane. And they had a VCR, and we're talking about 1997, so that was a VCR. And there was a movie. They put in a movie, and Trump got bored with it. And then he had Eric put in this old favorite of his. I think it was
Bloodsport.
Bloodsport, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, whose work I am unfamiliar with by and large. But it was just a lot of fighting, kick fighting, martial arts, and whatnot. And Trump had Eric speeding up the film to eliminate all the plot exposition and just reduce it to scenes of people beating each other up. And I at one point, some guy got kicked in the scrotum, and it was you know, slapstick, and I laughed, and Trump from across the way yells, "You're laughing! Admit it, you're laughing!" And he says, "You want to put in this article that Donald Trump is this kind of, I didn't say vulgarian, but you know, is watching this Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, and are you going to admit that you like it too?" Well, the only thing to do was to just put that quote in the piece. You know, I didn't argue with him. It was an odd moment of self-awareness on his part, but at the same time, when he said it, he was giving me a gift just by saying it.
Right. I love that moment, and it, for a couple of different reasons, and you know, one of them what you just spelled out, and also that there is a whiff there of what so many people find attractive about him, and refreshing, let's say, in contrast to the more carefully coiffed image that most politicians tend to proffer before the public.
Well, most politicians, they all have egos, but they also mostly have super egos, a voice inside their heads that says, maybe you don't want to go there right now. Maybe you want to watch your words. Trump has none of that, evidently. He's all id. And so the pleasure-seeking part of him is the part that predominates. Well, that is something that people really like to imagine in their own lives, the all fun part of it, and where you can do anything you want and there's no consequence. So I think most of us want to live lives more within the confines of what's safer, I guess is the way to put that. But Trump is a kind of fantastic aspirational figure.
Hmm. One of the most memorable moments in your time observing Mr. Trump had to be a moment which begins, in your words, with a transparent fib on his part. That is when he deigns to show you his apartment, or one of his apartments, but the apartment that he was and maybe still is proudest of. First of all, explain the way in which that those words from Mr. Trump's mouth were a transparent fib.
Well, this was the day it was just the two of us, one-on-one on a Saturday morning. And I didn't know where we were going, but I just was told to show up at the Trump Tower. There's a side entrance for the residents of Trump Tower. So I'm waiting in the lobby, basically. And the concierge says, well, go to the penthouse. Mr. Trump wants you to come upstairs. So I go up. He had this three-story, I forget how many rooms, 57 rooms, whatever, penthouse. And I get out of the elevator, and there he is. And he said, this was the transparent fib. He said, I thought I'd show you the apartment. I normally don't do this. This apartment had been in any number of lifestyle magazines. It had been on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. It'd been seen by hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. So the notion that I normally do this, that's just Trump. That's just palaver. I believe it goes beyond exaggeration into the realm of unconscionable lying. But anyway, so that was the sort of gambit for this tour of his home, and then we spent the rest of the day driving around and I described the scenes of that day.
So, just how amazing is that apartment?
Oh, it's amazing, but, you know, I'm not someone who finds money impressive in and of itself. So if you have a lot of money, you can do a lot of things with it. It doesn't mean that what you're doing is a reflection of good taste or good judgment. He had an ivory frieze inside one of these rooms. You know, this is a, you know, ivory is a no-no, as he himself acknowledged, endangered species. And he just what the hell. He just was going to spend as much money as he could. And it didn't. It ended up not being a place that looked as if human beings could live there. But it was certainly immaculate.
Right. I think you say at one point you couldn't imagine where in this apartment Mr. Trump would relax in his boxer shorts.
I said I couldn't imagine where it was where he relaxed and channel surfed while he ate roast beef sandwiches and scratched where it itched. So, you know, and that was that is that goes back to this thing that we discussed earlier, which is about the performance art. If you walk into my home, you're going to find a place that looks like it's lived in by real people. And you're going to wonder when it was last cleaned, probably. And that's life, you know, and he doesn't go in for that.
What do you think he was wanting from you, if anything, and what did you give him in that moment? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, do you think he wanted you to be impressed, bedazzled, and did you offer up at least the impression that you were impressed or bedazzled by what you were seeing? I mean, how did you handle this particular surreal sort of moment?
I'm very low key when I'm reporting, and I never want to make people feel threatened. I don't want to make anybody feel actually as if they're being judged. So, however I responded at the time, it was sort of appreciatively, he's showing me this stuff. But I didn't go into a lot of, oh, wowing. And I think it just, he can't help himself. He has to show stuff off. And I was just another, schmuck who he's showing it off to. I really don't think he thought about me at all. I just thought it was almost a reflexive thing that he has to do. To brag, to inflate, to rely on the appearance of splendor, as if that somehow is going to reveal good character. I don't know. It doesn't reveal good character in my estimation, but this is an unusual human being.
Right. We need to finish by touching on Donald Trump, the candidate for president, and in the last portion of the book where you offer some analysis of this, you flat out say, "I misread the moment along with 100% of the commentariat." What did all of you miss?
Well, I'm talking about the very beginning of the candidacy.
Right.
He entered the race in June of 2015, and let me say one thing. The one thing that I didn't misread was whether Trump's candidacy was the fact that he made, helped out the satire business. People like Jon Stewart, who I admired, Bill Maher enjoying, having fun at Trump's expense. But this is a guy who started his campaign by attacking Mexicans as rapists and drug dealers. And so I felt at the beginning, this is not going to be good for humor. It's not going to be good for anyone. But after that, I was flatly wrong. I didn't see that his candidacy was going to amount to anything. I really didn't read it correctly. But if you look back on that time, and the campaign, the histories that will be written of this political campaign will all, if they're honest, will all record that it was a universal failure on the part of the certainly on the punditry and as I say, the commentary among pundits and commentators. He was completely underestimated, and that meant that they didn't recognize the mood of the country, how much anger there was out there, how much resentment of elites there was, all legitimate. How much people, a lot of, I think, journalists or commentaries wanted to believe that that the people who were supporting Donald Trump were all racists, that they were sort of, and that wasn't true either, I don't think. I think they were people who'd been left behind, who had been lied to for years. They didn't appreciate that Donald Trump was selling them air, that he was just using, you know, this rhetoric and this demagoguery to, you know, basically for his own benefit, to feed his own ego, and that he didn't have their best interests in my heart at all. And that's played out over time. But at the get-go, I didn't see it.
A last point. So much of your book is about Donald Trump and, as what you see, a life lived out as nothing but performance art, as artifice. And yet he is regarded by his supporters as exceptionally authentic. In your mind, how do those two things square? How is it? How can it be if he is indeed as artificial a persona as you describe? How can he appear to be so authentic to so many people?
Well, what did P.T. Barnum say about fooling a certain amount of people all the time? And that is Trump's appeal. It's a P.T. Barnum-esque appeal. All you have to do is examine his record, have any sense of history. But we don't do that in this country. We don't really think in terms of causation over long periods of time. And people are looking for something different because they're dissatisfied. Look at Congress during the Obama years, especially, but certainly over the long haul. The fact that there are special interests that have a grip on how laws are made, and money, obviously, huge, big money is funding a lot of what goes on in politics. So people are angry about that, rightfully so. They're not doing a lot of listening to any of the particulars about what Donald Trump has been as a business person. And they're just fooled. That's the best answer I can give. Partly because they want to be fooled, but mostly because they really don't feel that they have a voice. And so it's easy to reconcile those things.
The book, again, is entitled Trump and Me. It's published by Tim Duggan Books and the author, Mark Singer. Mark Singer, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for being so generous with your time. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Greg. My pleasure.
Tomorrow and Wednesday on The Morning Show, you're going to be hearing my conversation with the author of a really interesting book called The Last Innocents. It's a look back at the 1960s and the Los Angeles Dodgers, recently transplanted from Brooklyn. And it's a story of how Major League Baseball was to be dramatically transformed in those years. In some ways for good, and in some ways perhaps for ill, against the backdrop of the turbulence of the 1960s. A really, really interesting story. I want you also to make special note of Friday's Morning Show, when I look forward to welcoming into our studios two faculty colleagues from Carthage College, Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg, who join us on quite a regular basis to talk about political matters. They will join us on Friday's Morning Show to look back at what will by that point be the recently completed Republican National Presidential Convention. They will offer their analysis of whatever ensues. That will be on Friday's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, wgtd.org. Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreagifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the work.